Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Coming up on this week's show, a legendary shooter gets a redux.
Use your Game Boy camera on the Switch 2.
And we go inside the world of Enigma Variations.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every week with our amazing sponsor, our friends at Bitmap Books. Now, one of my favourite books they've done in recent years. It actually is in stock right now. Game Boy, the Box Art Collection. Now, maybe you're an old-school Game Boy fan or maybe discovering the wonders of Nintendo's million-selling portable system for the very first time. This is a celebration of the finest cover artwork for Nintendo's monochrome Marvel, covering all the big games on there, Mario, Zelda, Donkey Kong, Metroid, Mega Man, Castlevania, and some obscure classics that you may have forgotten about as well, weighing in at more than 370 pages. If you love the Game Boy, check it out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 487, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the show, the podcast that comes out every single Friday just before the weekend and brings you up to speed on all the big happenings in the wonderful world of retro gaming and technology, and brings on veterans of the industry for an interview on every single podcast. Every Friday we bring you someone new to tell their story and tell us about the games they worked on, the companies they were involved with as well. And today, what about this for value? Not one, but two veterans of the industry on the podcast this week. We're going to be joined by Darren Melbourne and Mark Greenshields. Now, these are names that might sound familiar if you've been listening to the podcast over the last couple of months, because we've kind of been covering this this project they're doing at the moment with that brilliant website, The Games That Weren't, that's run by Frank Gaskin, which we've had Frank on the podcast before. An incredible website that aims to document video games that never made it to market. And actually, Darren and Mark have been working with Frank recently to preserve some of the games they made back in the late 80s and early 90s at their company, Enigma Variations.
Yeah, man. It was a really, really good interview. Obviously, we started with the roots of C64, etc., and how they both got into the industry and met, you know, which is always fantastic. But yeah, the meat of it was when it kind of got to the late 80s and early 90s, you know, and kind of their experience with Nintendo. You know, which is always great because we don't get to talk too much about Nintendo devs, obviously, you know, with Japan and everything, you know, and how Nintendo NBA are. But it's always great to hear it, you know, especially from like a British point of view as well. But obviously, as we've covered in the news segments over the last couple of months, a few of these games never came to light. And it was great to hear kind of like, you know, a more detailed kind of telling of what happened, you know, as well as how they made those games, because some of them are like, you know, 8-bit conversions of like, you know, Populous and stuff like that, you know, which is just absolutely insane to have running on the NES. But yeah, it was just great to kind of hear it, you know, as they say, from the horse's mouth, straight from them. This is how we made it. And then this is what happened. And then this is how we've got it preserved now. So it was really, really interesting. You know, it was kind of like a 3-part kind of story, you know, that we managed to cram. We crammed so much into an hour, and they even said we crammed so much, but also, you know, we as we always do, there was a lot of stuff they probably could have, you know, continued to tell about us. So, you know, maybe there'll be a part two in the future, but yeah, there was a lot of stuff in this next hour.
Yeah, we talked about like Sensible Soccer and Kickoff, and then a story that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, a lost beat-em-up game for the Super Nintendo called Mechanoids 2. And we asked at the time, didn't we? Because this is one of the games that you can actually download now, because Frank Gaskin at the Games That Weren't, he's actually got a load of Marxell discs. Some of these discs are like 45 years old. Got them up and running, and you can actually play these games that were never released back in the day. But we did say when we covered that, didn't we, a few months ago, we never heard of it. And like, was there a Mechanoids 1? What was kind of the story then? It's actually got a bit of a tragic history on that. You know, it was, could have been very different. So we hear all about that as well. And obviously today, Darren works at Retro Games Unlimited. So I did have to ask, you know, is there any update on the full-size Amiga? You know, they did the A500 Mini. There's been this talk about a full-size Amiga 1200. So we get a little update on that at the end of the interview as well. So as you mentioned, Joe, we crammed in a hell of a lot with our guests this week. Darren Melbourne and Mark Greenshields are our special guests on the show in around half an hour from now. But of course, before that, that's when we bring you up to speed on what's been happening in retro from over the last week. And this first story, this is going to take you back to getting back from school, maybe sitting there with a bowl of spaghetti hoops on toast, watching your cartoons.
It's time for Animaniacs, and we're saving to the max. So just sit back and relax, you'll laugh with the laughs. We're Animaniacs.
Do you have you singing along there?
I love that you had spaghetti hoops on the bread. I had something much more healthier, potato waffles.
Oh, yeah, yeah. turkey dinosaurs, yeah. Well, Animaniacs, obviously great cartoon series back in the day.
I loved it. Yeah.
Warner Brothers, wasn't it?
I thought it was just so sarcastic, really funny, Pinky in the Brain as well.
Yeah. Oh,
just I used to do an impression of the Brain, but I'm not gonna do it.
Oh, Rabbit, you can't use it like that. Come on,
Pinky, what have you done?
That's pretty good. But yeah, incredible series, and like you said, loads of different characters in there. Elmira, I think, was on there as well, wasn't she? I remember, who loved the animals and used to kind of stalk them.
Was that was the little girl on it who used to always go, "But why?" like that. Was that on Animaniacs?
Yeah, it might be. I mean, I haven't seen it for quite a long time now.
Tiny Toons?
Yeah. I always get those two confused as well. Yeah. It's around the same time, weren't they?
Yeah.
Tiny Toon Adventures. But again, they're very similar shows, weren't they? Basically a whole host of like mini cartoons that were all combined into one great series. But the reason we're talking about Animaniacs is obviously we're going to be covering unreleased games in the second half of the podcast. But now it turns out that a prototype for a previously lost Animaniacs game that was in development at a UK studio called Full Fat Productions back in the early 2000s, has now been found. And turns out it's pretty much almost complete.
Yeah, so what I found interesting about this was it was set for release in 2003, which I could be wrong, but I felt like Animaniacs was about 10 years before that. You know, and I know it ran
94 to 98, apparently, yeah. Then it had a revival in 2020.
Oh, wow, okay. So I just thought it was an odd time for the game to come out. But then I was also trying to think, because obviously the Game Boy Advance was, you know, for me, it was Super Nintendo. Like, so many games that came out on the Super Nintendo got ported to it. And I know there is a Super Nintendo Animaniacs game, but I've not played it, so I don't know if it's anything to do with that. But it doesn't say in these articles anywhere that it was, you know, it was just a re-release of that game or anything. It appears to be, I could be wrong, but it does appear to be its own standalone game. And the game was called Animaniacs Hollywood Hypnotics. And the plot was that you played as the Animaniacs, and Pinky in the Brain, as Brain always was trying to take over the world by hypnotizing the Animaniacs and turning their water tower, you know, the water tower that they lived in, into a rocket ship.
The Warner Brothers one.
Yeah, the Warner Brothers one, and turning it into a rocket ship, which does sound very Animaniacs and very Pinky in the Brain. But what I thought was quite interesting about this game is it was essentially a point-and-click adventure, but very similar to, I don't know if you guys ever played the Beavis and Butthead game for the Mega Drive and Super Nintendo. You know, it was kind of like...
Of course I did. I love Beavis and Butthead.
It's kind of like a point-and-click adventure, but without the point-and-click part. It's that, you know, running around, finding items, fetch questy kind of game.
Yeah, it says it's quite similar to Dizzy as well.
Oh, okay.
In that kind of section and puzzle solving, map finding and trading and stuff, and NPCs.
Yes, so you got to like trade with the NPCs and stuff, but obviously all the NPCs were characters from the Animaniacs show.
From the world.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it probably would have done fine if it did come out. The reason it didn't come out is just simply the developer, you know, they went bust, they ran out of money, you know, they, and the company shut down.
It looks like it was nearly completed. So yeah, to the point that the German packaging is actually out there. And there's photos of that, looking at, you know, the packaging. You've got the manual as well, and you've got the cart graphics there, which is really cool to see. So, you know, it must have been so close to release to actually have that all kind of complete and done. And it's even got that Nintendo seal of approval on it.
Right, yeah. Well, you can actually download this now and play it. This is from a preservation group called Hidden Palace. They've actually got a few other games from Full Fat, the studio that was behind this, who, like you said, went bust. Justice League Chronicles and Freak Style as well. They've got two early builds of that that you can download. And one of their team, Mr. Pinball 64, got hold of this prototype of the Animaniacs Game Boy game, and you can actually download it from the Hidden Palace website now as well, if you want to play it, if you've got an EverDrive, or play it via emulation. So, yeah, I mean, obviously we're going to cover more about this kind of preservation efforts in the second half of the podcast, but I also think it's amazing when, you know, these kind of long-lost games are uncovered, and obviously today, you know, you can just download them and play them on flashcards and stuff. So I think it's very cool that they, you know, cause like you said, you know, a lot of effort probably went into this. The fact that they were that close to releasing it must be kind of heartbreaking when you put all your time and effort into it and all that money and it never sees the light of day. So even if they're not earning cash off it, you know, 25 years later, the fact that people can still enjoy it, I think, is a really good thing. So, yeah, looking at this little gameplay video that you can watch, about 20 minutes long. Looks graphically really nice, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It looks like a polished Super Nintendo game. You know, that's how I always saw the Game Boy Advance. But yeah, it looks really nice.
Yeah, so when you get hold of that, that is available for download now. So I'll put a link in this week's show notes. Now, a game that I think is definitely a bit more up your street, Ravi. I'm going to be talking about Postal. I know we did an episode about Postal, didn't we, back in the day?
Yes, we had Vince Desi, the producer of Postal, on. And It's a really interesting game, very controversial, very 90s. One of the original kind of like shock shooter titles, a very black trench coaty, and very satirical as well. Postal 1 was, yeah, a bit grim in today's standards. Postal 2 is a lot more fun, a lot more comedy based, and actually out of the series I think that is the one that people played the most, and it looks like it's going to get a redux.
Yeah, so I did read that. I mean, I must admit, I'm not a huge Postal fan. I've kind of played it in more recent years. I have read that Postal 2 is kind of where the series peaked, and it kind of fell off a bit after that.
Yeah, it fell off, it went to different studios, and I think every Postal after that has been a bit of a disappointment, really, especially for Postal fans.
So they are bringing back the highlight of the series, and Postal 2, getting a redux. Apparently not in production yet, but they're going to be starting a crowdfunding campaign. And that's
going
to be
starting this summer. Which I would definitely back, because this is one thing I've wanted for a long time. They have a lot of add-on packs, and there's a lot of, like, you know, multiplayer was always good on that. It's going to be interesting seeing a redux, because it is one of those, like, you know, Half-Life, when they did that, that had such a feel of the kind of that era. Postal kind of has a feel of the engines running, you know, the way that people react to you in the street when you're doing stuff. The city is really a living city, and it's got that free roam first person shooter element, as well as puzzles. It's going to be interesting to see how they censor it, if it does get censored.
Oh, they can't, surely.
With modern standards, I think they can't with Postal, can they? They've got to go fully out. And there is some stuff that is very, very questionable nowadays, involving race and stuff like that. So we will see. But it looks like they're going to have high-res textures, dynamic lighting, as well, and a zero load streaming world, which is really good, actually, because as you'd enter different sections of the map on Postal, they would load, so you get your loading screens, and you'd have to, it would kind of slow down progress if you were on like a rampage and stuff. Having that one world is going to be more exciting when you've got the police chasing after you, and you know, people trying to shoot you. Of course it's going to have all the mad stuff that you had. One of my favorite ones was the cat gun, where you had a cat on the end of the machine gun and you'd fire it and it'd be like meow 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 meow. That was pretty cool. It's also gonna have breakable interiors. Now that's a big development as well, because everything in Postal was kind of just solid flat,
yeah,
and You know, Duke Nukem 3D, you had some of those interactive elements in first person shooters and stuff. You had that kind of style where, you know, you go up to something, there might be a bit of interaction, but you couldn't like blow up stuff and have junk and smash up the house as much. And a lot of the identity of the buildings inside and stuff were pretty similar. I think they're going to have to stick to the same map, though, if they're really doing a redux, because it's legendary.
Well, apparently it's going to be a fully reimagined paradise, the saying.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So maybe an improved paradise, or yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right about that, having the breakable elements in the game. It always frustrates me that you might be the same Joe, even in some, like, you know, the recent Call of Duty games. You might walk up to a TV and you shoot it and, like, you know, sometimes nothing happens, and some of them you might get a little bullet mark on the screen.
I think it's mirrors like, that do my head in.
Yeah.
When you play a modern game and mirrors don't work, and you're like, they worked in, like, Mario 64. Like,
yeah. It surely wouldn't do that 25 years later. Yeah. So I think, yeah, it's always frustrating me in games, though, when you can't interact with things like that. So, small point,
it's,
but yeah.
It's got some great add-ons as well. Extra games like Paradise Lost, Corkscrew Rules, Apocalypse Weekend was one of the first ones, and Share the Pain as well. So I hope that's all added in there. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I'd love to see it come out for the systems. And surprisingly, I think the one that would probably approve it first is the Switch, which is crazy. But Nintendo these days would probably be like, yeah, Postal, sure.
Yeah, stick it on. Okay.
We'll let you on, yeah.
Well, this is Flat 2 VR Studios Team Beef and Running with Scissors, who are the teams behind this as well. So they're going to be giving the 2003 open-world shooter a massive upgrade and loads of improvements. As we said, no firm release date as yet, but they are going to be doing a crowdfunder for it, which I think is fair enough. You know, before they put all that work in, they want to see if the demand's there, which
I'm sure we're seeing. I think they're going to have to, like, show some of it, because people have been burnt with the kind of later Postal titles and lots of promises. I remember many people getting, I think it was Postal 3 or 4, and it just being broken, and it being broken for so long, it became a bit of a joke.
Well, there is a very short teaser. It's only like 25 seconds. It's basically just the entrance to paradise.
Yeah.
The town in the game. It kind of zooms out on a wasteland. But, you know, graphically, that little teaser does look quite nice. But obviously, it's going to be coming to Kickstarter this summer. So one that we'll keep an eye on and let you know when we hear more. Now, still haven't got my hands on the Switch 2. I've been trying all that harder for Monos, though. But I will
I was
at some
say,
point.
You keep what? Saying that. I'm like, how hard are you trying?
Not really, no. I looked at Amazon on Friday. I was like, oh, they haven't got it in stock. I'll try next week.
Dan's just asking so someone sends him in one.
Oh, if anyone wants to, feel free. Feel free. But I mean, there's like, what, two or three games for it at the minute? I'm not in a mad rush to get hold of one, if I'm honest. I'm sure there won't be in a short supply by like the end of the summer. So not in a huge rush to get hold of one.
You might be now, though, Dan.
Well, I mean, one thing that I did actually eye up when I was checking out the things that you can get for the Switch was I liked the look of that Piranha Plant camera, which I think I sent to you guys, didn't I, before the launch of the Switch? Mm. One of the cameras for it that looks like Piranha Plant from Mario. I think is one of the coolest things I've ever seen. Although, there might be an even cooler camera add-on that someone's got running on the brand new Nintendo Switch 2. Someone's managed to get a Game Boy camera working on it.
I mean, I could be taking this for granted, but it doesn't look too hard to get it running either. So it looks fantastic. You know, it shows him off. It's a guy called Andre GX. He's got a YouTube video on it, which is great. And in the footage, he's playing Mario Kart World Tour. And, you know, his little, like, you know, picture, his little camera picture above him while he's driving around racing people and stuff is like the black and white, pixelated, grainy Game Boy camera. And I'm like, that's fantastic. I'd love to do that. But how he's got this to work, it is from original hardware, from the original Game Boy camera hardware, but he uses it in a analog pocket. So the analog pocket plays Game Boy games. So obviously the Game Boy camera will fit obviously into the, you know, into the analog pocket. And then he from what I understand, is he uses a video capture device which outputs the HDMI signal differently. I'm not 100% sure how that works.
Yeah, so he puts it into the pocket dock, basically.
Right.
So that the output of, like, the pocket is HDMI.
Right.
And then he just gets the signal capture device.
Yeah.
And then
plugs that into the Switch 2.
plugs that into the Switch 2, and that basically detects it as a camera. So in theory, I guess you could do this with anything that had a HDMI output, you know. But having that kind of Game Boy camera and the Nintendo connection is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised, not so much that it works, I was more surprised that Nintendo haven't put a lockout into it that, you know, to make only the official Switch 2 cameras work with it. You know, interestingly, it is an official Nintendo product that it's ultimately using, although there is, you know, a bridge in the middle of two devices, three devices in the middle there. But I was more shocked that, yeah, that you didn't have to use the official cameras like the Piranha Plant and stuff.
I wonder if maybe Nintendo are thinking of releasing, you know, they did the GameCube controller, didn't they, for the Switch 2. Maybe they're going to bring back the Game Boy camera for it.
Yeah, that would actually be... No. You know what? That would sell well, actually, if they just did it as
it
a...
Would, yeah.
Yeah, just the webcam, but it's the Game Boy camera. You heard it here first if Nintendo put that out.
Yeah, have that idea on us, Nintendo. Yeah. Probably a higher resolution today, though, I imagine, because the original Game Boy camera, like you said, monochrome, came out in 1998. Output today, whopping 128 by 112 resolution.
Nice.
So compared to the 1080p of the modern Switch 2 cameras, does give it a very cool look, I think. You know, definitely stands out if you're playing Mario Kart with that. So yeah, very cool. I'm going to check that video out. I'll stick that in this week's show notes. Now, while we're talking about video, full motion video, obviously an era in gaming back in the early 90s, it kind of came and went pretty quickly. But we have seen a bit of a revival of FMV in recent years. Now we're all getting nostalgic for that era again. This one's pretty nuts, though. Now, this is something for the Playdate. So, we did talk about the Playdate when it first came out. For those that don't remember it, it's a handheld console that's got some quite unique mechanics, including a crank on the side of it, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's got a crank on the side of it, which was interactive with some of its games and a lot of like the built-in games that it had with it and stuff. But this is what is baffling me. So, this is an FMV game called Blippo Plus. That did come out on it 6 months ago, but it's now coming out on the Switch. And this game looks crazy bizarre. And it's definitely like a weird, sinister kind of like undertone to it if you watch the trailer. But what I don't understand is, and I could be wrong with the Playdate, but did the Playdate only have like 8-bit graphics or black and white graphics?
It was monochrome, yeah.
It was monochrome system. And it was an FMV game for that, but how it worked on that was it released like an episode a week. And what Blippo Plus is, how do I describe it? It's an FMV game where you can switch between the channels of the game, and that's what it's going to be. And you can fast forward time and like rewind time and stuff like that in it. And it's to kind of like discover what the story is. But I don't really know how that worked on the Playdate, but it's now coming out on the Switch.
So you'd turn the crank and you'd change the channel, basically skipping through it. But then there's stuff like hidden data within the program guide, messaging systems as well, messages that are hidden within certain sections of it. There's like a theme that runs throughout the whole kind of TV show and what's going on in that crazy, weird sci-fi looking world. And, you basically find out what's going to happen in this world. And I think it's kind of like an investigative game, but very much in a channel flipping way, which looks amazing, to be honest. I think this is really unique. And all of it looks like it's been done through like a CRT filter. There's so many like
bit of VHS
logos.
Effect on it as well, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's VHS effect. It's not an effect. It was filmed that way. It was filmed on original analog.
Nice.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. So the whole thing of it as well with the Blippo Plus was all of it was filmed on 80s and 90s TV studio equipment.
The news looks mental in it. There's music videos as well. I really want to play this. This just looks like the bonkers, most weird kind of title out there, to be honest.
One thing that's insane to me, though, is so I was kind of looking at, like you said, how this worked on the Playdate. And yeah, there is, if you go to Blippo.plus, which is the official website, they're calling it 1-bit television. So basically, they down-resed it into monochrome on there. But what's nuts is that they basically made like a week's worth of television programs for this.
Yeah.
So they're actually filmed. It's like 11-week live-action TV shows, loads of different genres, soap operas, chat shows. So they've actually made all these programs. And I kind of went down a bit of a rabbit hole and looked at like a few Reddit threads about it. So I wonder whether it was kind of baked into the game. But apparently they are actually streaming this from their servers. So it is almost like a real-time television stream.
Wow.
Which is quite cool, with an EPG.
Whoever thought of this, it's like, oh my God, wow.
Yeah.
And the publisher's called Panic. It looks like they've done some interesting games before as well. I love that though.
Yeah, they haven't got an exact release date for when it's coming out on modern platforms, but you can wishlist it on Steam right now. Great little trailer as well. It kind of shows a virtual play date on screen as well. I think really interesting. I mean, I love games like this. It kind of reminds me a little bit, obviously, much more developed of something like Night Trap or even like Voyeur on the CDI.
Yeah, I think FMV, like the way that you do interfaces and stuff and the way that you play them, everyone's unique, isn't it? And
yeah.
This is just another way of kind of exploring it. But I love the retro sci-fi like look of it. I think everyone just looks a bit weird. There's like a weird edge to everything. And it looks a bit like public access as well. And yeah, just great.
Even like the on-screen graphics look fantastic down there. So
yeah,
well done.
Yeah, there's a bit of like Teletech style graphics in there as well.
But yeah, I think just in terms of like a really unique game mechanic, I'm really interested in this. So definitely one that I'll be checking out. I mean, on the play date, obviously it's very limited, but I think being able to see it and all that kind of, like you said, that analog color glory, you know, recorded on old school hardware just looks really well done. So I'm going to keep an eye on that. That is called Blippo Plus. I'll link that in this week's show notes. Now, just one final story. Patrons get a couple of extra ones in just a second. But for everyone else, last one this week, Windows 95, which obviously celebrates its 30th birthday this year. One of the biggest operating system releases of all time. Maybe getting a bit nostalgic for it now that it has been 30 years, thinking, wouldn't mind reliving my Windows 95 days. Well, someone's got it running on hardware that you may very well have set up in your gaming den. It's been running on the PlayStation 2.
Yes. So Metrobyte is the channel. And it's pretty interesting, this video, because we've seen like, oh, Windows 95 running on the Game Boy, where it is just like, you know, a designed environment.
A simulator, really.
Yeah, a simulator of it. This is actually running Windows 95 on the PS2. And interestingly, it's done through DOSBox. Like, that's the way that he's done it. He's created the build, tried to get everything installed. It's very slow. It's very confused. Partitioning the hard drive takes him a long time. A lot of the setting up he actually does on his PC in an emulator because he can speed that up. Doing it in real time would have taken hours, days even. He ended up kind of getting it running. He's trying to run Doom on it. Fails. It's not amazingly usable, but interestingly, it does look like it is something that could be done as well. So apparently there's a version of Windows NT that would be a bit more compatible with the PS2 because it's kind of based on the architecture and you wouldn't be using an emulator. So I think it's pretty interesting, but essentially he is doing it in DOSBox. If you could break free from that DOSBox world, maybe there'd be some possibilities.
When you've got to have a modded PS2, uses free MacBoot.
Oh, yes. Easy to do now, isn't it, though? And he's loading it all off a USB stick as well.
Which, again, is the limitation because it's only got USB 1, hasn't it? I think it's 1.5 megabits a second that it transfers. And he's using an iMac hard drive in an external enclosure in this video as well. So that's obviously a massive bottleneck, using that ancient USB interface on there as well. There are a few problems because he uses DOSBox originally. Like you said, there's some file system issues. And then he swaps over to using an emulator called Box, which actually gets CD-ROM supported on here as well. So he manages to mount the Windows 95 CD and the floppy disk to boot as well.
But do you remember installing Windows 95, how long it was?
Yeah.
it was
40 minutes or something, I think, on
Yeah, it'd be like, I'm going to do a fresh install. And then, you'd just be sitting there for a very, very long time. That one that I mentioned earlier, someone mentioned in the comments of the videos, is Windows NT4 has a MIPS version, and PS2 uses a MIPS processor. So that might be interesting to see.
I mean, we'd say then, you know, installing Windows 95 back in the day in your Pentium might have took like 45 minutes to an hour. This took him about 14 hours to install on his PlayStation 2. Left it running overnight. There are some limitations. No mouse support, only the keyboard worked on it. The UI, I mean, if you watch his video, really, really slow moving. He did actually manage to get an image in Paint, save like a blank image using the keyboard shortcuts only. So navigating Windows 95 using a keyboard plugged into the PS2. As you said, he did try to get Doom running on it, and it runs Windows 95 very poorly. Not practical to run gaming or anything like that. It's just a bit of novelty though, isn't it? Often the things we cover on this podcast are, there's no real reason to do it, it's just cool that you can.
Yeah, I love videos like this, silly kind of exploration ones, you know.
Have you ever managed to get an operating system running on a console? Because I know you could do like Linux on the PS2 and PS3, couldn't you, back in the day?
Yeah, I haven't really actually. There was some like Dreamcast stuff, but it wasn't really an OS. I've not actually done that. That is mega kind of geeky, but also pretty cool. Like, I like the idea of repurposing a device to be like, oh, I'm actually doing work on something that's designed for gaming. Kind of reversing it around a bit.
It wasn't that story about like the US Air Force who built like a supercomputer using like 2000 PS3s. Back in the day, I remember they're using it for like radar enhancement or something like that. And apparently they built like this cluster, made it into a supercomputer, because obviously they're really cheap compared to...
They had a Yellow Dog Linux, didn't they, originally? That got removed in later versions.
Yeah, so... But no one was running Windows 95 on the PlayStation until now. So if you want to check that video out, I put it in all the rest of the show notes on your podcast app. We can head through to the website at theretrohour.com. Now, for patrons, we'd have a couple of extra news stories on the way for you in just a second. And other great patrons hang out at the weekend as well. We do these at the end of every month.
Awesome. Yeah, I really loved it. Yeah. Thanks for all the new people that turned up as well. And it was quite nice as well, because not everybody has a camera on there as well. But, you know, even if you haven't got a camera, you can get involved in the conversation.
Yeah, now these are some of that we do at the end of every month. If you haven't joined us for one before, if you join our patron right now, which really is the lifeblood of this podcast, helps us keep the lights on, helps us bring you these interviews every week, brings a podcast out every Friday, helps pay for all our servers, all our editing software, everything really. It's, so we hugely appreciate your support.
It's crazy. We put some pictures out recently of the kind of inception of the idea of the Retro Hour when, we came up with it. 10 years ago this week out in the Netherlands. And, you know, I think without our patrons and our listeners and, you know, supporters, we wouldn't be here, you know. All this time later, having wonderful interviews.
Yeah, so we really, really appreciate your support. So if you'd like to join our community, we give back as well, like you said, invite every month to the Hangout. It's basically a massive Zoom call. We just geek out for a couple of hours at the end of every month. New episode of our Patrons Only Gold Members and Above podcast, The After Hours, is live now by the time this podcast comes out, where we talk about our technology firsts. That was a fun chat. And you get the normal podcast ad-free, a few extra stories each week as well. But really, just to support the show, make sure we can keep bringing out every week all the details to join our wonderful patrons community are at theretrohour.com. Okay, well, thank you for checking out the news this week. We'll update you again next Friday. And next, we're going to be joined by two incredible guests this week, going inside the world of Enigma variations with our guests Darren Melbourne and Mark Greenshields. They're next on the Retro Hour podcast.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it's time to welcome on this week's very special guests. Now, today we have got two guests who are going to give us some really interesting stories, I'm sure, of starting back in the 80s on platforms like the Commodore 64 and the Spectrum, going into console development as well, companies like Enigma Variations, and preserving forgotten cancelled games. and lots more as well with our guests this week. Let's welcome to the show Darren Melbourne and Mark Greenshields. How's it going, guys?
Yeah, good. Good. Thank you for having us on.
Yeah, appreciate you having us on. Should be a good hour.
Appreciate you taking some time to come on and do a bit of reminiscing with us. Now, there is one question that we always like to start the podcast with, just to kind of get a bit of background on our guests and find out kind of where it all came from for you guys. So we'll start with you, Darren. I mean, do you remember what initially got you into gaming? What was kind of your earliest gaming memory?
My earliest gaming memory was playing Pong in 1972, which I would say I was 4 years old, and it was the one and only time my dad could beat me at a video game. So I remember we were at a holiday park in Devon, and Pong was a very new thing, and we came across it, and I was sitting on his knee, and I was obsessed with it from that point onwards. It really was. That was a seminal moment in my life. I can still quite clearly remember that Pong machine, where it was, everything about that room with the Pong machine in it. So my gaming history, my love of gaming, goes back to that point.
A lifelong love of gaming started there on Pong.
Absolutely.
Amazing. What about you then, Mark? What's your earliest memory?
I think I was a little bit older because I actually, I'm a couple of years older than Darren, so I tended to play outside a lot. But my earliest real recollection of, I'll call it game, you know, electronic gaming, was I was at school and a friend brought a ZX80 to school and I went, This looks cool. I mean, it wasn't actually that cool, but in those days, it had buttons, it had things they could do that were more than just misspelling words on a calculator screen. So I started playing with it, realized this is fun, this is addictive. And, you know, from then on, literally, you know, it was VIC-20, Commodore 64, everything, playing a load of games. But I realized really early on, I want to make stuff. I don't just want to play stuff. So it really was. I guess I was 15 at the time, so a little bit older than Darren, but it's kind of been addictive ever since.
And what's the story with you guys getting your first systems then? What about you, Darren?
So my first system following along from that was a ZX81, which, as Mark just alluded to with the ZX80, was exceptionally limiting, but I still remember one of the most elating moments of my life was programming a jumping man up and down in BASIC. I thought it was the best coder in the world at that point. And then from there, migrated through the Spectrum and then onto the mighty C64, which is around the time I met Mark. So I'll let him take over at this point. But I guess I was 15 when I met Mark, fully in love with my C64. And then that's where I first met Mark at a Commodore show at the Novotel Hotel in London.
Well, the first system I got was a ZX81. I managed to use pocket money from paper rounds, and get a bit of my parents to get it for Christmas. So I got a ZX81. Told myself to program it, realized this isn't that good, I could do better. And during that time, I managed to get a Saturday job in a store in the middle of Glasgow. It was called Waterloo Strip, and I think it was called Microsystems or something. So I became a Saturday boy and managed to convince them to let me get a VIC-20 out of my wages. So they actually gave me the machine, and I hadn't paid for it. So that was quite cool. And I really got into it then. And then very soon after that, once I started programming, I wrote a game called Bomber or something. It was like the typical thing when it was, you're flying over the city and you're dropping bombs on all these skyscrapers. And I managed to, you know, I programmed it in BASIC, put it together in cassettes and started going to some of the local stores and actually selling it in the local stores. Very shortly after that, I went across the road and realized I had met a company who was going to be the Scottish distributor for the Commodore 64. So I went in, spoke to them. They said, "Oh, you program." I went, "Well, yes." I mean, arrogant little kid I was at the time. They said, "Well, could you write us our shop demo?" I went, "Yes, of course I could do that, but you'll have to give me a 64. So they did. Serial number 2. Of the PAL Commodore 64. It lasted 3 weeks and died. Then it got number 11, and that didn't last much longer. And then it got some 31,000. So I actually did write the initial window display software for the Commodore 64 to the Scottish distributor. So it kind of all took off from there. And, you know, as Darren alluded to, I was well into playing games and sporting games. And I went to a Commodore show down in Novotel in London. And we met through friends that... a friend that I had actually got through CompuNet, which for anybody who is not of our generation, was a 1275 modem with basically a bulletin board. You could talk to other geeks who were interested in computer stuff. And I met one of our, who became a joint friend, introduced me to Darren, and, well, history came from there.
So you mentioned the game there called Bomber. So we read that your first credited game was Bombo on the C64. Is that the same game? Was that a separate game? What's the story there?
No. Bomber was I did my own sort of publishing label called Digisoft or something like that. I've still got it somewhere in my cupboard. Printed on a printer, cut out myself, put in cassettes and everything. But that was just sold locally in stores.
Got you.
Bombo was, so this was when I was doing BASIC.
Yeah.
And then while I was doing that, I started to learn machine code and realized, at first it didn't click. It was like, this is just odd. And then one day the light went off I just got it. So I was actually at a computer show in Edinburgh with a friend, another friend that became mutual friends. And I saw a guy called Tim Hartnell, who used to run a book publisher called Interface Publications. His books, shall we say, were a little bit inaccurate. My friend went over to him and told him I thought his books were SH1T and really, really put me in it. He came over and spoke to me and said, I hear you think my books are I went, no, I just don't think they're that accurate. And he said, can you do better? Again, the arrogance, and I mean, it sounds arrogant, so I wasn't, but the confidence in you said, yeah, I could do better. So he gave me a contract to write a book. So everything sort of went from there. So it was a lot of fun, you know, really enjoy it. I think those really were the enjoyable days where, you know, in those days, although I was playing a lot, I realized there was a career here. I think Darren, he'll come on to himself in a second, but for him, it was more games at the beginning, and then his light went on, and he realized the direction he was really good at. So it was all fun, and, you know, given the fact we're talking in the 80s, you know, and we're so passionate about it now, you know, it says a lot about not only the environment and the sort of encouragement that we had with the groups of people we knew, but just, I guess, the 64 and what we now call the retro scene. That's why we're still talking about it 30, 40 years later.
Well, Darren, tell us about kind of your entry into the industry then. What kind of got you interested in like game design, you know, beyond just being a games player?
I think really when I first met Mark, I think there was a group of us learning to code and tinkering around at the same time. And what I rapidly realized was that my coding was not up to par compared to especially Mark and another mutual friend of ours called Charles. They were leaving me quite far behind. And it makes you quite despondent when other people are picking it up a lot quicker than you. And B, I just didn't really have an eye for coding. As Mark said, a light went on one day and he understood 6502 and the structure of code. I didn't follow the same path. Whilst I could understand the structure and I could technically get it, my coding ability let me down. What I was good at, however, was interpreting ideas in my head onto paper and helping people build the game. So I think for me, it fairly much came around that my friends went on to be the coders in our groups. Some of them, Ned Langman, went on to be an artist that we all grew up with, of great repute and still working. In fact, he works still at Antstream to this day. Mm. And I kind of, by default, took over production and design from that point onwards.
Well, what was your first company then? Was that Paranoid Software, the first company you guys set up?
It was the first official company myself, Mark and Ned Langman set up together. I mean, prior to that, we were working on individual games. We were testing Bombo with Mark, and we were always up at Firebird with all the guys up there, Colin Freege, Joe Bonar. We were helping them game test games up there as well. And I think it was being in that environment. Bearing in mind, I was 16 years of age, bumbling around through Telecom Soft and Firebird and everywhere else at that time, helping them game test, meeting up with Rob Hubbard and people like that for the first time. And there was just a buzz. There was something about the industry that was very young at that time, but we just knew then that it was going to be something big and it's something we wanted to be a part of.
And what can you tell us about Split Personalities? Because that was your next game after Bombo. Did you learn a lot from doing Bombo? What was the story there?
Mark, I'm going to let Mark now talk for the next five minutes. But there's a great story behind this.
Yeah, there is a bit of a story in this one. In, I guess it was 85, I'd been trying to do university and college and everything else, realized I wasn't cut out for designing microprocessors. So, and I got in touch with Domark they were in Wartburg Road, I think it was, in Wimbledon. And they needed a programmer to write James Bond games. That was a lot more interesting than designing microprocessors and doing some of the weird maths that they do in that. So I ended up jacking it in, taking a job, moving to London, much to the chagrin of my parents. They were horrified at that. But why don't you get a proper job? Well, this is cool. So I did that. I moved down there, started coding. I think it was Live and Let Die. I can't remember, but it was the one. And was enjoying that. And then Mark Strawn, who was the joint CEO of Domark, said, we've got this game. Well, it was called Splitting Imaging at the time. We want to do it on the Commodore 64. Would you like to do it? And I went, yeah, sure, I can do that. I'll do it in the evenings, blah, 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 blah. So we agreed it. We agreed a timeline and all that sort of stuff. And I started writing the game. I'd been working on it for perhaps a week when he came back with a smile like a Cheshire cat going, I've got it into Boots. We've got a really good deal with Boots. It's got to be there on, I can't remember the day, the 23rd or whatever it was. We went, oh, that's cool. And, you know, it was going to be the 30th. But I was a week earlier. I can manage it. He said, this month? I mean, what do you mean this month? He said, yeah, we signed a contract. It's got to be there in 3 weeks. I go, I've been working on this game for like 3 days. And he just went pure white because he signed it here and said, oh. He's very polite, sort of upper class type voice, but the ground fell beneath him and said, can you do it? And I said, well, I don't know. I mean, at that point, I'd been writing Bombo, but Bombo had not actually been published at that point.
Right.
So although it was a running game, I technically hadn't finished a game. So I said, well, I'll do my best, but I'm going to literally have to work all day, all night, you know. So we agreed how I would do it. I won't go through all the agreements and financials and everything else. So I started work on it, and I ended up, the artwork was being done by my then boss, a guy called Richard Naylor, who his name will come up later on as well. So I started writing that in Domark offices, and I basically did not leave. I left to shower and change clothes. Other than that, I didn't leave. And they frequently would find me in the morning with my head on the keyboard and the line of 80 A's, because, of course, the keyboard buffer got filled up. So I did that, lost some code. It taught me a lot about backing stuff up. But it was fun, and we got there, and I managed to deliver the game with 4 hours to spare.
Oh, God.
I have no idea to this day how I did it, because I had never written half of the stuff that was in that game. But I managed it, did it, and it was probably one of the best games I've ever written. Now, there was one bug in it, which we did fix later on, but we got it shipped. Everybody was very happy. And I'll add a little bit to the end of the story, which isn't quite as fun, but, you know, I'm still here. I took a week off after that because, you know, literally I'd killed myself near enough. Drove up to Scotland to see my friends, had a week, you know, typical kid, had a good time, fell asleep on the car on the way down and ended up in the ditch after doing 18 miles an hour. Probably should have died. I missed every truck, every car and every road sign, and that was it. But so that was my early days into crunch mode, which is one of the reasons why I'm not a huge fan of crunch nowadays. But it's still a story I tell to this day, and it's I'm glad I did the game, because the game was great. I mean, Darren was around, he was playing it a bit, and we got David Whittaker to do the music. It was just a really fun game.
Mark, you shouldn't leave out as an example of what crunch mode is like when you woke up in the middle of the day and had an argument about what time it was.
I had no idea where I was, mate.
I believe didn't you come down at 2 in the afternoon claiming it was 2 in the morning and couldn't work out why it was sunny outside?
Yeah. Then again, time didn't matter. It was like if I was awake, I had to be typing. It was that simple.
It was one of those things where it didn't matter what we did. We were trying to prove to him that it was 2 in the afternoon, not 2 in the morning. He thought he'd missed the deadline. He'd fallen asleep. He'd power napped for half an hour.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And he came down. He had an argument. We're showing him our watches. We showed him it was sunlight outside. And he kept saying to us, you're lying to me. You're lying to me. I've missed it. Luckily, as Mark said, he made it with 4 hours to spare. He didn't miss it.
Yeah, lack of sleep can do funny things to the brain, can't it?
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, sleep deprivation to the extreme. Could never do it now, but I mean, I'm glad I did it. You know, it's one of those things where if ever in the future of my career, I said to anybody, I'm sorry, guys, we've got to do a bit of crunch. Mm. No one had done crunch like that. So
yeah.
I wasn't asking anybody to do anything I'd not done myself, but I still would never advocate that anymore. It was
well, the game reviewed well after that, and obviously, you know,
good. Yeah, we got a zap sizzler, was it, or whatever their top thing was.
Yeah, CBG hit, apparently, yeah.
So we were well chuffed with that.
Let's look at the journey from Paranoid Software to launching Enigma Variations, then. How did that go, then? What was the journey between the two companies?
Obviously, Darren and Ned, we did a couple of games. We did some stuff with Nexus, and we were doing well, but I mean, let's be really honest. We were kids. You know, I think I was probably maturing a little quicker, but we were kids. We were having a great time. We were a bunch of buddies building video games. You know, you can't get much better than that. But I kind of started wanting to earn money. And I got called up to do a job. So we did Paranoid. We did a couple of things. We had some fun stories that we will never admit on air, but you know, we just had a good time. But we delivered games. But then my ex-boss from Domark, he moved up to a company in Harrogate called Cascade Games, which I think it was called the Cascade 50 or something, like 50 rubbishy games for £10 or £5, whatever. And they had the license to 19 from Paul Hardcastle, which was the song about, I think it was the Vietnam War. And he called me up going, we've got a problem. We've got to ship this game. And our programmers are way behind. We just can't do it. Can you help? So I drove up to Harrogate, had a look, said, yeah, I can do it. In fact, I can do, there was more than half the game left and they had four programmers on it. I said, I'll do the rest of it, no problem at all. So they agreed. We signed a deal. So I started doing it. And I ended up, I ended up moving up. I was living, I think, in Croydon at the time. So Harrogate, much, much nicer part of the world. So I moved up and carried on writing. Within a month, Cascade went bankrupt. And they went through administration and they tried to squeeze everybody out. So ultimately, I still finished the game. I got paid for it just, but that happened. But I, at that point, I thought maybe we should set something up. So I talked to Richard, who was my boss at the time, who obviously he'd lost his job as well, and said, let's set a developer up. So we thought it was a good idea. And I'll give Richard the due. He came up with the name of the Enigma Variations, which obviously came from Elgar's music. I hadn't heard of it. And then I went, ooh, I like that name. So the name started. And we started at the beginning of December 1988 in a rented office in North Park Road in Middle Harrogate. And we went from there. So that's how Enigma started.
How did you get involved, Darren? And I know you're working on licensing deals, weren't you, initially?
So how I became involved was, in the late 80s, when Mark was setting up Enigma Variations, I became the first employee of a new publisher called The Sales Curve. So I was still down in London. And then I worked at The Sales Curve for just over a year. I then jumped and went to Pantheon Software, which was a couple of friends of ours, Andrew Bowen and Mike Green, who were just a couple of guys jobbing, looking for work, scrabbling around to get contracts. I had built up quite a good network of people at that point, so managed to turn up on Mike Montgomery's doorstep one day and said, we can put Speedball onto a C64, no problems at all. Mm. So I was doing that kind of thing. And then Mark, when he was traveling, he was coming down to London quite a lot, would just stay with us over in Bromley in southeast London. And the more Mark was coming down, he was saying, look, mate, you should just move up and work with us at Enigma. You should just come up with us. So I went up for a weekend, had a look around, found a beautiful place called Knaresborough in North Yorkshire, went back to London on the Monday and said, I'm moving to Knaresborough. And within 3 months, I'd packed up and gone. And that was it. I moved up from that point on and decided I'd just go and work at Enigma with Mark.
And was it hard getting the deals for licensed titles in those early days then, Darren?
Do you know what? Back in those early days, it was the Wild West. It was right. It was easy. Mark, tell me if I'm wrong here. And again, I won't say this openly on air. I don't think it's perhaps a touch unfair. But back then, the amounts we were paying for licensed titles and you know, things like Hanna-Barbera characters, Warner Brothers characters, I'm talking single-digit thousands. It was incredibly easy. It was there was one licensing agent in London. It was much easier than it is today, where it's grown up and developed into a real competitive, high stakes business. Back then, it was very simple.
Yeah.
Do you think it was just they didn't understand video games as like a kind of something that would be popular then?
It wasn't even a hobby. It was just one of those things that parents thought, you know, it's a passing fad. So. Yeah, I mean, as Darren said, it wasn't that difficult to pick up. You know, we picked up a lot of contracts, things like The Lion King and other big brands.
Well, that's Mark. To be fair, that was slightly later, and I think
I suppose earlier on, you know, we started. You know, we did work for hire projects, but we also started site projects like I'm trying to remember. Oh well, Defenders of the Earth, Gilbert the Alien. I managed to get a deal with Aston Martin, an exclusive deal. Cost me nothing down, sensible royalty. I mean, I unfortunately never turned into something, but there's enough, you know, and that's another story. And we picked up James Herbert books. We picked up tons
of Blyton, Famous Five.
Yeah, Enid Blyton, Famous Five. And, you know, most of these we either paid nothing up front or pennies, and we paid a royalty. You know, so compared to nowadays, as Darren said, it was a Wild West. You know, we were a couple of bolshy British guys, we just seemed to be able to get them. I wish we'd actually done more with it. I think we didn't realize in those days quite what we were managing to achieve. You know, I guess the ignorance of youth or whatever you want to call it. But it was so fun.
I think that's a fair comment, Mark. I think back then we figured that everybody would be doing the same thing. And it transpires when you look back on it that they weren't. I mean, I think we were the first licensee of Hanna-Barbera in... certainly in the UK, but maybe even in Europe, working with their licensing agent, Yaffa. And again, they had no appreciation of the value of the licenses they had at the time. And as such, they were picking figures arbitrarily out of the air. But and I will say this, because they had worked previously in books and film and TV, they looked at our little cottage industry, didn't think that we had any real value in it. So they were picking really low figures. And, you know, when I say single-digit thousands for Bugs Bunny, Roadrunner, Daffy Duck, things like that. It was quite easy when you're selling a game at $1.99, $2.99 with the budget companies that were around at the time. It was quite easy to get a return on investment on those games.
Yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned it about the budget companies as well, because obviously, I mean, you went into consoles later on, but originally we're talking about, you know, the 8-bit micros, really, C64, Spectrum, Amstrad. I mean, was it, how did you juggle all the different versions of the games then? Because I imagine, you know, different architectures on different systems and having to have, you know, multiple cassettes duplicated, that kind of thing.
Yeah, honestly, it was actually, I found it surprisingly easy. I mean, one of the things that we did do quite early on was, I actually invented a multi-platform game system called Enigma Code in the late 80s, which basically was the first multi-platform game engine anywhere. Problem was, we couldn't get programmers to use it. Oh, we can do it better ourselves. Yeah, you could, but we could use one programmer in 3 weeks to build 7 versions of the game back then, you know, whereas everybody else was doing it. So, I mean, we did loads of games with that, like the Wombles and Sooty and Sweep and loads of other budget games. But it ended up being myself and Richard Naylor were the only two people who programmed it, because all the other programmers were too proud to use it. But that was one of the things. But mostly, you know, it wasn't like it is now. So we tended to, you'd have a programmer who knew, say, the Spectrum and the Amstrad, one who knew the Commodore 64, maybe sometimes the BBC, and then later on the Amiga, the ST, and things like that. So it was just teams. I just don't recall it being difficult. It was just something you did.
So you mentioned the Wombles there and, you know, Bugs Bunny, Wile E. Coyote, etc. Lots of big licenses. Obviously, a very big British license. There was Thomas the Tank Engine and Postman Pat. What do you guys remember about working on those titles?
Never wanting to hear the Postman Pat song tune ever again. No, I am joking, but when you hear that bloody black and white cat the whole time for months on end, you know, they were just fun. I mean, yeah, they were kids stuff, but we enjoyed it. I think we created good games in general. I mean, there was a couple of serious thinkers we wrote, or I did, but they were fun games. And, you know, they were cool licenses yeah, there were kids stuff, but nobody else was doing it. So it was great fun. We really enjoyed it. I think Darren would definitely attest to a lot of that.
Yeah, no, it was a great period of time, to be fair. I mean, you turn out a game design in 2 days that included maps, that would include enemies, aliens, patterns, front end, back end. You'd turn that out in 2 days. Within 6 weeks to 8 weeks, you'd have a game finished and you'd be on to the next one. It's certainly different from latter experiences where moving onto console, things would take 6 months and then a year and then 2 years. All of a sudden, you're into 5-year development cycles. So it was certainly more fun in that regard.
Yeah, we'd often go, you know, to get a publisher deal, we'd go have a meeting and arrange a deal there and then, instead of months and months of negotiation. And that was great. There was some downsides, though, mostly down to our waistline, because we spent most of our time in an office eating food and working. So that was a definite downside of it. But again, I wouldn't swap what we did for the world.
We talked about those different platforms that you released titles on. One interesting platform, you're one of the largest publishers for the Sam Coupe.
We were the largest.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was the story there then? And why? What did you think of that machine?
Oh, Mark, I mean, the Sam was really your baby. It was your concept. You and Richard decided to back the Sam Coupe.
Yeah,
I was more skeptical at the outset, and it proved to be hugely profitable for us. So it was a great move on behalf of you guys.
Yeah, basically, Richard and I met, I can't remember the name, but the founders who created
Sam. Miles Gordon Technologies.
Yeah, that's right, Miles Gordon Technologies. So they were somewhere in Wales. We went down and we met them, and nice guys. And we decided we would start writing stuff for it. They pretty quickly, from what I recall, I think this was before we actually published anything, they went bust. And then they sort of tried to come back to life. So we ended up, instead of working and writing games for them, we thought, you know what? Why don't we set up basically a club, for want of a better description, for people who have bought this computer so we can supply games for it. So we created a mail order club. So we did do some retail games, but most of it was sold by mail order. And we did become the biggest publisher in the world on that platform. Now, granted, we are talking small, but we did defend it. We did a load of really cool titles. And, you know, we'd come into the offices, Darren will remember, you know, and every morning the postman was arriving, well, pretty much swearing, lifting bags, and I mean big sacks full of mail. And these mail had checks in it, or cash, people ordering games. It was wonderful. I mean, for a bunch of kids who'd grown up building games, you know, it was fantastic. And we'd go to London, we'd do shows, we'd sell them over the counter. It was just a great time. Unfortunately, as often happens, piracy killed that because people started copying the games. And we tried telling people, you know, if you're going to pirate these games, as we are by far the biggest supporter, and I mean, we were only selling small numbers of units, but it was enough to make money and do it, then you're going to kill us. And unfortunately, that's what happened. People started pirating and it became unfeasible. But for about a year and a half, it was a really great time. And I've got a soft spot for that machine. Unfortunately, I don't have one because I used to. And later on, the company, Darren, was looking after some of my computers. And he got flooded in his basement. Everything got trash. So I don't have one. But now that you've mentioned that, I've got to find one again just for posterity.
It was nice hardware, wasn't it? I think it's maybe just unfortunate timing, wasn't it? Because everything was kind of moving 16-bit then, wasn't it, when that was released?
I think that's exactly it, yeah.
Yeah, it looked a bit more like an ST on the screen, but, you know, with enhanced spectrum architecture, but it was cool. It was a nice machine and it was a nice time. It was a nice time to be doing games.
And I know you didn't ask, but I think the two best games we did were Escape from the Planet of the Robot Monsters and Clax. I thought they were excellent.
They were.
So how did you make the move onto consoles? You know, you worked on Nintendo licenses quite a lot. Did you have to get a Nintendo development kit? What's the story there?
Well, before Mark goes on, and Mark will now explain this, I'll tell you a really interesting tale, which most people don't believe, but I will tell you is true. So when we were still at Paranoid Software, and we're going into the late 1987, early 1988, Mark and I were sat in the office one night. I think we'd had a few ciders and a bit of pizza. And we were talking about the NES, and we were aware of it. And we were very skeptical because we were such big C64 fans. We couldn't work out why people would think the NES was better. And we were dismissing the architecture and everything else. But what didn't get lost on us were the reports we were getting on how many the thing was selling and how many games you could sell. And we realized pretty much that it was probably going to be a good place for us to move as a small development company. So we decided on that night after a few ciders that somehow we were going to reach Nintendo. And it literally came as simply as Mark and I sat in a room and got international directory inquiries. We got a telephone number for Nintendo. I believe they were in Seattle at the time, Mark, if memory serves correctly. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, and you were.
After a couple of ciders, we got placed through to Nintendo of America. Somebody answered the phone. We said, we'd like to speak to the person who gives out the licenses for Nintendos, please. And on that evening, we spoke to a gentleman called Howard Lincoln, who we only learned many years after was the president of Nintendo USA. But for them, again, they were quite a new outfit at the time. And bless him, he humored us. He said to us that they weren't giving licenses out. We said, well, we know people over here are developing it for it. And he said, yeah, they've gone and bought kits and they've disassembled it. I invite you to do the same. And right. that was my first conversation with Howard, and I didn't speak to him again for about another 6 years. He didn't remember it; we did. But yeah, that was quite an experience to get hold of the president of Nintendo on one night after a couple of ciders sat in our office.
I can imagine that's just insane. Half cut. He's like, "Who's this young British guy?"
Exactly.
Just going,
well, do you know what?
Get a Nintendo kit.
Do you know what? I think it was very similar to that. It really was.
Yeah, that is sort of what you did. You just pick up the phone and a bit of gold. I mean, we weren't embarrassed about it, and it was cool. But as Darren said, we didn't realize quite the significance of that call.
So what happened then?
After that, we got in touch with Anil Gupta at that time it was Annie Rog, who were doing a lot of basically rip-offs of arcade games and were very well known on the Commodore and I think the Spectrum, but, you know, that sort of scene.
Yeah, yeah.
And went down to see him, and I started talking to Anil. This was around about the time that his partner Roger died, and it became Anirog. It became Anko, rather. And he had been doing, obviously, was well known for a game called Kickoff. And he went, I would like to put this on the Commodore 64. So we said, yeah, no problem at all. So we started to write it and put it on the 64. As it turned out, the coder that we had writing it, who I'm not going to name for his own benefit, struggled and couldn't do it. So yours truly had to take over. Just as we were starting to do that, Anil gave me a call and said, I've got a deal with a company called Imagineer in Japan. We want to put it onto the 8-bit Nintendo. Could you help me? Of course, my ears pricked up, but ooh. So the only problem was the only documentation he had was in Japanese. I don't speak Japanese. I don't read Japanese, but I can read programming. So I taught myself how to program the machine, had it running on the machine pretty quickly, and we carried on. Ended up actually traveling to Tokyo many, many times. There's a bit of a funny story there. So this was really the start of getting into console. And I was the game was nearly done. It was crashing. Couldn't fix it. He flew me out to Tokyo. I spent a few days with supposedly their best programmer, and we were trying to figure out this bug. And 3 days after being there, and you can imagine I was tired, I was typing something because we couldn't figure out this bug. I knew it was something to do with the interrupt, but I didn't know exactly what. So I typed something on the screen, and this Japanese guy who didn't speak any English typed an answer in English. And I went, type back. You can read English? You went, yes, I can read and write English. I just can't speak it. So FaceTime time. So I asked him my question, and he went, oh, yeah, you've got to do this before that. I went, okay, change the goal. There we go, job done. Turned out, you know, for anybody who's techie, you have the IRC interrupt and the NMI interrupt, which I think I've got the words right, given that over 40 years since I did it, the NMI would take precedence over the IRC, but I was depending on the other way around, and that's what crashed it. So we fixed it, got it out published. Carried on doing, you know, and from then on, Darren and I realized that really consoles were the future. I mean, but obviously by this time, things at 64 and that were dying down. They were still around, still, you know, but we thought we'd get into console, and we started discovering, you know, the DS, Game Boy, and just the list went on from there. But we were still doing computers as well, the Amiga, the ST, and everything else. It just became another platform. And quite honestly, that's all we were. They were just another platform, another way of doing a game.
Well, we have been covering on the podcast over the last couple of months, really, this incredible preservation effort you've been doing with the games that weren't, which we'll talk more about that soon, because I think that's really interesting. But kind of going back to when it happened, so I know you're working on an NES version of Sensible Soccer. What was kind of the story there, and why didn't it eventually get released, that version?
With most of these things, it was we ran into a lot of, we would be commissioned to do something towards the end of a machine's life cycle, and whilst the development got signed off, people were invested in making the game. What ended up happening 6 months later, when you finished the game or came close to finishing the game, is the sales team would then turn around and say, actually, we don't think we can sell that anymore. The Super Nintendo's taken over. We can only sell 10,000 units, not the 40,000 we thought we could. At which point, your development, no matter how good it is or how far along it is, will just get canned. Mm. And that happened to us on repeated multiple occasions.
Oh, many, many games.
Because that version, by the looks of it, was pretty much finished, was it then?
We were in final bug testing.
Yeah, it was in final. I mean, I think they published the Game Boy, but for some reason, the NES version. Yeah, the NES just decided never to be published. Well,
I was just saying, the reason for that is that the Super Nintendo had usurped the NES within the home market. The Game Boy still stood alone as the best portable game device.
Yeah, so it was a terrible shame. It's not the first time, and it won't be the last time that sort of thing happens, where you write something that's just exceptionally good. I mean, could I have done a better job? Yes, I think I could. It wasn't perfect, but given the timeline we had, it was pretty decent. But, you know, it is what it is.
Mark, another one that, you know, had the similar fate was Populous for the NES as well, which was another surprise find. How did you approach converting a God Sim to 8-bit?
So, at that time, we had two different development teams on that, because we had a really tight time schedule. In fact, we were first approached to do it, and we were like, we're not altogether sure we can do this. And we alluded to a guy called Andrew Bowen, who worked for us earlier on in the conversation. And Andrew said, actually, I can do it. I'll do a line-for-line conversion, which sounds insane when you're talking about taking a 68,000 game and putting it onto a humble NES. But he was sure he could do a line-for-line conversion that would work in a speed that would make the game playable. We had a secondary team working on the Game Boy version, and it far outstripped their capabilities, which was a real shame. They were a decent pair of guys working on it, but they just couldn't handle it. And just when we thought we were going to have to go back to Imagineer and say, well, we can't do the Game Boy one, Andrew then turned around and said, well, actually, I can do them both. I can code them concurrently, which we then thought was completely insane. But he went ahead and proved us wrong and coded them, one in Z80 and one in a variation of 6502, and he proved us wrong. He wrote them both, which was quite astonishing. The problem we had there was that there was an expectation within Imagineer, and to some degree Bullfrog, but obviously Bullfrog were developers. They understood a machine's limitations far better, I think, than the publisher did. I think there was an expectation that they were going to get a full-color Amiga-style game, when, of course, that was never going to happen on the NES. What we were doing with the screen manipulation was so difficult. It was always going to run in a far less on-screen colors and resolution, and worked in a smaller window. And I think they were quite disappointed at first. And then Peter Molyneux played it. We took it down to him. He suggested some tweaks. And then he signed off on it and said, this is excellent. The guys have done the best job they can possibly do on this platform, which was a great endorsement from Peter. And sadly, again, we fell prey to the fact that the game had sold incredibly well on the Super Nintendo. It was doing great business. They didn't believe they could sell anything like they needed to on the NES, and the game was canned. It went ahead on the Game Boy. It was the best reviewed Game Boy game we ever did. I mean, and I think Lion King gave it a run for its money, but Populous was the highest reviewed Game Boy game we ever did. And unfortunately, the NES version was doomed never to be released until recently. Good old Frank found the code again.
Yeah, we'll definitely get into that, because that's a really interesting story. Just while we're on this era as well, though, because, I mean, you're doing various different platforms at the time. I mean, and Mark, you also did the DOS port of Turrican 2. So what was it like kind of converting an Amiga Classic to MS-DOS?
I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about it too. Honestly, it was code. I mean, anything, you know, a lot of people say, oh, how do you manage to do that on a platform? We didn't And I think that was one of the things that we had. We didn't have any fear. It was just like, well, let's just give it a go, basically. You know, and usually one of the things that I think helped me as a coder was a few of the guys that we worked with as well. There was no such thing as this is impossible. It's like, how can we find a way? And, you know, part of the way I taught myself to code was hacking other games. So I was learning how systems work, figuring out how do I get round things. To the point, like on the 64, you would learn to time the raster by single instructions, single cycle, not instruction, to move the raster beam across the screen. So we were constantly figuring out how do we make things do things that it shouldn't do. I mean, I think this is, you know, all the demo writers on the 64 were all like that. You know, it was just because it wasn't designed to do that doesn't mean to say we're not going to do it. And I think that was just part of it. It was, we can do it. Was it the arrogance of youth or just confidence or whatever? I don't know. But, you know, I guess there wasn't really a fear of failure. We just did it. And most of the time it worked. So I can't give you any reason. I mean, I remember going over to Germany with Darren. We had a long chat. We met. I can't even remember the guy's name who wrote it, but yeah, that I do remember. I'm trying to remember the programmer's
name. Yeah, there's Manfred Trenz and Julian Egebrecht.
Yeah, Manfred.
I still deal with Julian to this day.
Yeah, Julian did the audio, but it was Manfred, I think it was the coder, wasn't he?
Manfred was the coder of the Amiga version.
Yeah.
So you've mentioned a few times the Lion King for the NES that you guys did.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the Lion King... You know, really, really famous. Well, it was a really, really famous movie, really, really famous game. Classically, the 16-bit versions of those games are incredibly difficult. And the story goes, you know, it's because Disney wanted people to rent the game for longer. You know, they didn't want to complete it in a weekend. So, one, I was wondering, you know, what's the story behind Lion King and, you know, getting the license there for the NES version? And two, was it a straight-for-straight port, or were you told to make the game difficult as well? Was there any kind of instructions from...
Let me run with this one, Mark. So this came about because I was quite friendly with some of the guys down at Virgin, yeah. And in particular, a lovely guy called Ian Mathias. And Ian just contacted me and said, look, you guys do conversions. Can you handle the NES and Game Boy version of The Lion King, which, as Mark said earlier on, we just said yes pretty much to everything.
Yeah, yeah.
We assumed we would find a way to do it. I would say that nothing at that point in my life had prepared me to working with a company like Disney. I have never experienced a company that sent such a comprehensive, and we've worked on a lot of licensed product at this point. I'd never experienced anything like the style guide we received for The Lion King. And their expectation, again, this is between a publisher and developers, and Virgin were trying to mitigate some of the sheer amount of mail that was flowing backwards and forwards. But Disney expected like for like. They expected a Super Nintendo version on a Game Boy, which is monochrome, and an NES. And it couldn't be done in the same way. So I would say it was faithful to the 16-bit originals in as much as it emulated the levels. I would say that it emulated the level flow, but we had to redesign fairly much everything within the levels to make it work within the reduced formats, within the memory, within everything we had. And I will say that I think in the last 8 weeks of that game, the amount of tweaking that we had to do on Simba's animations, and they just couldn't understand that we weren't dealing with a 16-bit platform. In fact, or we weren't dealing with a film. And that's the level of animation that they required. So I will say that was an exceptionally testing development. There's also quite an amusing tale attached to the back end of that, which I'll share, which is we were due to get a royalty on the game. We were due to get a dollar a unit on the NES and Game Boy, which, you know, we thought we'd make some money off it. However, and this is the way that so many things tended to work around those times, we ran out of money at the end of development. We set a development budget for a period of time that we thought we could achieve. However, with all of the back and forth with Disney, it probably took 3 months longer to get through approvals. And we ran out of money. So I went back to Ian, I went back to Virgin and said, look, guys, we're basically out of cash. We can't finish this game unless we get another cash injection, which they very kindly said, we'll fund the next couple of months. But to do it, you have to forego your royalty. Now, we were like, oh, gosh, but we could make some money off this. And Virgin came back to him and said, look, guys, let's be realistic. This is at the end of the sales cycle of these machines. You'll be lucky to break even. So, you know, we'll stick an extra 5K on. And what do you think? And we, at the time, as so often happened with a small development company, we looked at each other and said, well, we need the money. So we took the decision to waive the royalty. I believe that at last count, including the THQ remaster and reissue, it had done somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million units on the Game Boy alone.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was a bitter pill to swallow, let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
But it's indicative of the way things work back then.
Yeah.
One of the things that, you know, we discovered, neither of us were formally, shall we say, trained in business, even though I'm a motor dealer, a small one. We woefully undercharged in those days, but we still delivered everything we did to a standard higher than most of our competitors. You know, I wish we'd had a little bit of business training, because that deal, there's no way we would have accepted that. Fortunately, later on, I mean, we can get to a couple of things later on that aren't retro, where I guess I got the royalties out of Disney and actually ended up changing their business model for developers because they paid so much on a game. But that was another story, but we definitely lost out big time on Lion King, which was a shame because we did a really good job of it.
I was going to say, from licensed products in latter years, probably the two best games we worked on were The Lion King and The Addams Family. I think The Addams Family on the NES and Game Boy was also an outstanding conversion. Another strange tale on the NTSC NES version, we didn't have a test unit in the office, and we were basically running out of time to finish this game. And it was complete. We had everything. We'd converted faithfully the entire Super Nintendo game to the NES, and it was a quite an epic conversion. But Ocean were reporting a bug, and we couldn't replicate the bug in our office. So they offered to lend us a kit overnight, to see if we could work it out. So I drove to Manchester from Harrogate. I think I did the journey to their office in about an hour and 20 minutes, which shows you how fast we're driving, because that's fairly much impossible. Bought the kit back, and sure enough, the bug occurred on this test kit that I bought back. But it didn't occur on anything else. So, you know, I'm phoning the guys back in the Ocean office. It's about 11 o'clock at night. I said, does it occur on anything else? No, it doesn't. I said, well, what's different on this test kit? And they said, well, it's a Nintendo version 4. I said, right, okay. And they went, yeah, it only occurs on the Nintendo version 4. And it was a glitch at the top right and left-hand side of the screens, like a corrupted sprite, top and left-hand side, about one character square. And we couldn't find out a way to eliminate it. And we said, well, guys, you know, how crucial is this? Well, Nintendo won't pass it unless it works on all versions of the NES. So we're laboring it. And in the end, if you look at the version, there's a tiny sprite of a cobweb on the top left and right corners of the screen. It was the only way we could mask the fact that there was corruption underneath. Well, in about 6 months after this, the game got released, great reviews, everything else. I was over at the Ocean offices, and I was like, oh my God, you know, do you get this problem often with the Nintendo version 4? You know, out in the wild, are people reporting problems? They went, oh, it was never released. And we said, sorry. And they went, yeah, the version 4 never got released because it had a problem with the graphics chip.
So, no way.
Despite the fact that the machine never got released because of a problem with the graphics chip where it was out of sync with every other variation, Nintendo still wouldn't approve your game if it didn't run flawlessly and the same as everything else on the Series 4.
On this prototype that was never out there anyway.
Prototype that never made it out into general
That's
release.
That's hilarious.
And although, again, it's...
Remember, though, on the Game Boy, the one that had that fault, I managed to get hold of one of those units that I still have.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There was a game. I can't remember if it was the same game or another one, but I remember having exactly that problem where it was a version of the Game Boy Black and White. It was only released in Japan. It was some, and there was very few units. Nintendo wouldn't supply one. Nobody could give us one, and I managed to get one from Julian Rignall, and I remember swapping him a color Game Boy for that. I think it may have even been in the Sears Tower in Chicago, but we met him. But I remember swapping it because we realized he had one of those machines.
No, yep, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I remember that now.
And I still have, I will never get rid of that. I mean, that machine is like, and I can't remember which game it was. It might even have been Kickoff, but there was one game that we had to fix using that. So Nintendo did that every now and then. They seemed to have machines that were out there, but you had to test, but they couldn't give you a machine.
That's nuts.
It was nuts.
One title that we've talked about in the podcast recently as part of the preservation effort that we'll get into more in just a second was a side-scrolling beat-em-up game that it was made in 1993, Mechanoids 2, The Final Conflict. So when I read this article on Time Extension recently, I'd never heard of this before. And so I've got a couple of questions. I mean, what's the story with it? And was there ever a Mechanoids 1?
No, there wasn't.
Darren, there's so much frustration with this, but Darren will
tell you. The reason it was called Mechanoids 2 was just, I would say, a play on words between myself and the guy that designed the original. So I say the original, it was designed originally by myself and Ned Langman. We decided we wanted to do a beat-em-up where you could replace robotic parts and you could upgrade the robots. This would have been early 80s. And because we never did it together, when Mark and I put one together, I said, well, we've got to call it Mechanoids 2. And he said, why are we calling it 2? And I said, well, really, it's a bit of a conceit because Ned and I designed Mechanoids 1 and we didn't do that. So we're going to make this one Mechanoids 2. And it was going swimmingly well. It was a lovely demo we put together, and it was due to be signed to Imagineer, and we were really, really pleased with the way it was coming on. The graphics were being built by Alan McFarlane and Chris Edwards. I think Paul McKee also had some graphic work input on it, and everything was ready to go. And then we ran into the populace problem, and I'll refer to the populace problem. We were working with a third party. When Mark says about Anil Gupta and Anko, all of our development work with Imagineer pretty much was via Anko. He was their distribution partner in Europe, and he took all of they took all of his games into Japan. So we didn't have direct contact with Imagineer. We had a direct contact with Anko, and the problem that we discovered was we would get a time frame to develop a game in that we weren't actually being given the realistic timeframes by Anil, who was telling them something completely different. I guess he was trying to appease them. If they needed something, he'd say we could do it. Blatantly, we couldn't. And I think Imagineer felt aggrieved that Populous had been delayed in its development cycle. And I think it was delayed by about two and a half months in the end. There were some problems during development. I think the real problem is we hadn't anticipated the sign-off via Bullfrog, I believe EA had sign-off on it, Bullfrog had sign-off on it, Anko had sign-off on it, and finally Imagineer. And when you're building four different companies into signing off one project, and every change that has to be signed off by four different people, it inevitably causes a massive delay. And I think it slowed the project down by a couple of months. The problem is then we'd agreed to do Mechanoids 2 with Imagineer. When it came to signing off on it, they didn't want to sign off on it because they were, in only the way I would say that a respectful Japanese organization can be, they were clearly aggrieved with us and wanted to teach us a lesson. The problem with it is we couldn't also necessarily get a release from them to go and do the game elsewhere. So it kind of languished for some time. And then Imagineer withdrew from the games industry. They pulled out sometime after that. And really, by that point, the impetus had left us. It had gone and we'd moved on to other things. The team that we'd assembled to build the game had moved on to other projects. And we never had really had the opportunity to get everybody together again. So it was a passion project for us. We think it would have been fantastic. And in fact, it's fair to say that the game would have been signed by Gary Bracey at Ocean, who at Summer CES, when we demoed it for him, said 100% we're your publisher, and Imagineer had already said they were going to do it. So we told Ocean we couldn't do it, and that opportunity went away. And by the time Imagineer decided they weren't going to progress, we'd lost the opportunity to create the game, unfortunately.
I mean, it's a shame. I mean, I love my belt-scrolling beat-em-up, so it's a shame you know, that these things happen. But then, I guess this segues very nicely into my next question is obviously these games have been popping up all over, you know, kind of like retro gaming scene recently and in the news, something we cover a lot on the podcast as well in our news section. So obviously a lot of these games have been preserved recently by the fantastic guys at the games that weren't. How did that come about? How did Frank Gaskin get his hands on the old dev discs? Did he just call you guys up? What's the story there? How's that come about?
To be fair, I've known Frank for a number of years, and I've always been impressed by what Frank and his team do. And some years back, I'd send Frank all of my 1541 discs, and he'd he'd uncovered this 66 Sputnik demo on my discs, and he was absolutely over the moon because he thought it was lost forever. And as to how I came to have it is a very long story involving shady people turning up in our office one day and leaving us with a batch of discs. But lo and behold, I found them in a garage and sent them to Frank. So we'd kept a relationship going for the past probably eight or nine years now since I first met Frank. And through that entire time, I kept saying to him, there is a treasure trove. It's like the Ark of the Covenant sitting somewhere in Mark's storage, and I'm going to get it off him one day. And I've been bugging Mark for a long time, but this stuff is obviously, it's not his priority. I think it's fair to say, Mark. And I can only thank you for the fact that you actually had the good sense to back this up and preserve it in a place where the weather didn't degrade it, and it was still in one piece. And I really made it a bit of a mission to keep bugging Mark over the past couple of years, to the point that our assistant, Sophie, who works quite close with me, she's one of the production assistants at Retro Games Limited, had a rule that she would hassle Mark every 2 days. From this point onwards, she would message Mark every 2 days until he finally brought the discs over, which seemed to work because Mark got frustrated and bored with constantly being chased, and bless him, dug them all out, and they're all in good shape, and basically passed them all on to Frank. And again, Mark, I can only thank the lucky stars that you kept everything.
Yeah, luckily, I mean, a lot of this stems from, I think I mentioned earlier on, I think this was when I was writing Split Personalities. Obviously, on those days, you wrote everything on a cassette tape and then on disc. And I remember losing, I think it was like a week's worth of work. It may not have been that game, but it was around that era. And of course, being self-employed, no one was paying me to redo that work. So I had to redo it in my own time. And that taught me a massive lesson of backup, 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 and many more copies of backups. So anybody that's worked with me since, I'm constantly ripping their ears to backup. And if they do, they get one warning, and then I get really quite pissy about it. So I've always been obsessed with a lot of backups. And I was lucky because obviously I had stuff in the UK, but then when I set DC Studios up in Glasgow and then Firebrand and everything else, I always had an office. And being as this was all history and stuff, I never threw any discs out, any machines out. I kept them all. And as Darren said, at least they were in, you know, an office. And then when I moved over to Canada, I brought some of them with me and moved to the US. They've always been kept somewhere. And even though my wife says, why do you get rid of this old junk? It's like, it's not old junk. This is my history. I'm never getting rid of it.
Yeah.
So I just always kept it. And then Darren hassled me. So I started collating it together. And some of this has been piled in a storage unit full of junk and everything else. So it took a while to find it. And there's still more. I mean, Frank has not got everything I've got, but he got a lot. So I found the majority of the 5 1/4s and everything else and got them across to him in January this year, brought across in a suitcase, and I was dreading. I was thinking, I've had these things for 45 years, more. What if the airline loses the suitcase? So I did put a few in my hand luggage, but I was, you know, I had air tags in there to track it. Luckily, they all arrived and they were all fine, so I gave them to Frank. And I honestly didn't think he would get that much off them. And most of them, the guy's a star, because it's a lot of work to get this stuff off. And it's amazing the stuff he's found in there, both Darren and I had forgotten about. There's still one thing he hasn't found, which I'm hoping for. As I said, I wrote books. I wrote 4 books. 3 were published. One of them was Mastering the Amstrad CPC. Has never been published. It's on a floppy somewhere, and I hope he gets it. Because then one of our good friends, Paul Andrews, who's also a partner in Retro Games, does book publishing. He can actually do a first edition of a never published book. So I'm hoping that can be found. It'll be there somewhere.
If anyone can find it, Frank's the man, isn't he?
Oh, so, absolutely, he's the man.
Well, also, Mark, there's a complete Commodore 64 game somewhere, which is a game called Phantomass, which you converted from the Spectrum for Codemasters, which was never published.
Yeah, that will be somewhere. That's very true.
Well, obviously, we'll keep covering it on the podcast as and when things get found, and I'll link up Frank's amazing website in the show notes as well, so people can click through. Guys, it's been incredible hearing some of your history. I mean, obviously, we didn't mention there, Darren, that you are one of the founders and directors of Retro Games Limited.
Indeed,
I mean, obviously, people wouldn't forgive me if I didn't ask if there's any news on the full-size Amiga. I keep seeing stuff online about it.
Well, look, our release date of, I think, Q1 next year is what we said. I think this is what we're still aiming for. This is what we're still sticking for. anybody that's around the Amiga scene knows that there have been infighting and squabbles and unbelievable battles that go on behind the scenes between the various factions who claim ownership, who do actually have ownership, and over literally everything from trademarks to operating systems to versions of Workbench. This is quite well documented, and it slowed things down just a little bit. But, you know, we work incredibly closely with the great guys over at Cloanto. They're our partners and our friends in everything we do that's Commodore-based. And we remain confident, you know, we've been working on this for a long time now, and we remain confident that we are going to be able to ship at the beginning of next year as planned.
Fantastic. Well, I love my A500 Mini, so I look forward to getting my hands on that. Well, guys, it's been amazing. Obviously, you're part of AntStream as well, which, you know, a lot of the games that we've been talking about, you can play on AntStream as well.
You can.
So you want a really convenient way of playing them these days. So I'll link all this up in the show notes. But Darren and Mark, it's been an absolute pleasure to hear some of your history. So thanks so much for coming on and being our guest this week.
Guys, thank you for your time, and thanks for asking us on.
Yeah, we had a great time.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.